Thank you very much, Greg, for your introduction. I have tried my very best to make it boring. Actually, I feel I'm a natural, but I haven't yet fully succeeded. But thank you for the invitation to come back to Brisbane. Economic conditions here in Queensland have been quite varied over recent years. You don't need me to tell you that. In some ways, the forces at work have been parallel to those that we observe nationally. On the one hand, the expansion of the mining and gas sectors has driven strong growth in the regions. A couple of figures there. Just in the past 4 years, business investment spending in Queensland rose by 75%. It totaled $230 billion over that time, almost $70 billion last year alone. And the proportion of Australia's business investment happening in Queensland has been unusually high over these last few years. Investment in the mining sector is peaking. It may already have peaked, but the capacity that has put in place is now supporting strong growth in exports. Queensland's coal exports this recent February have reached a record high, and of course exports of gas expected to get going later this year. So that's the resources sector. On the other hand, in the urban areas of Queensland, like other parts of Australia, households have become more prudent after an earlier period of rather free spending and borrowing, and that's kept spending and therefore economic activity in the urban areas somewhat more restrained. There's also been a marked slowdown in the property sector in southeast Queensland, maybe a little more so than in some other states, and that's been a dampener on economic activity. Part of the story here, I think, is that in an earlier time of easy access to credit, dwelling prices rose really too high relative to incomes, in some areas at least. There was perhaps, in a few cases, too much construction of the wrong sort of dwelling, and some people involved in or exposed to the property sector had too much leverage. So when credit conditions tightened and there weren't enough buyers, prices fell and construction slowed down significantly. After growing at an annual pace of 12% from 2002 to 2009, dwelling prices in the city of Brisbane fell. And though they've started to lift a little bit lately, they remain 5% lower than their peak. About a third fewer dwellings were constructed last year than in the peak year of 2008. Building approvals have been strong in the resource-related areas in the regions, but elsewhere in Queensland, dwelling construction in recent years has been weak. Actually, that's something that the American members of AmCham who might be exposed to the US housing sector would very much have felt in the United States in recent years. The US construction sector, clearly, I think, on the path to recovery now, is still only building half the number of dwellings that it was at the peak in 2006, and in fact is producing at about two-thirds of its rate of 20 years ago. Now, at present, there are welcome signs that I think that the Queensland housing sector is starting to lift off the bottom. But the point I'd like to make is that this has been a very long cycle. The way I've thought about this is the ratio of Brisbane prices to Sydney prices. There's no particular magic in that metric, but it's just one that I think is illustrative. Historically, the prices of houses in Brisbane was usually about 60 or 65% of the level of Sydney. At the peak, some years ago, they reached about 85% of Sydney levels, and now they're back to 60 or 65% again. That cycle has taken 10 years. That the cycle can be so drawn out is a salient lesson, and not just for people in Queensland. Even if a full-blown crisis doesn't eventuate, and it didn't in Australia, overdoing it on housing on the way up is usually followed by a fairly extended period of working off the problems. We've heard a lot of talk recently about the effects of severe weather in the United States economy because of the severe winter conditions this year. And those effects have complicated considerably the task that my counterparts have over there in assessing the strength of the US expansion. Well, as you know, weather events have been important in Queensland in recent years, and some of these have been very costly. Not so long ago, the problem was severe flooding. But at present, much of the state for some time now has been in the grip of drought. Crops have been reduced substantially, and the livestock industry is likely to take a number of years to recover from the need to reduce herds. Farm incomes are falling, possibly to their lowest level for three decades on some estimates. I don't think that will complicate the RBA's task so much of reading the Australian economy, at least not to the extent that the Fed has faced in the US, but these nonetheless are quite significant effects in the regions where they occur. Our discussions with tourism operators, on the other hand, suggest that conditions there have started to improve. No doubt this is partly a result of the somewhat lower levels of the exchange rate since its peak last year. Over the year to September of 2013, visitor spending in Queensland increased by more than 4%, which is in line with or maybe even a little higher than the medium-term average growth rate. Tourism operators have been tailoring their services very sensibly to suit the rapidly growing segments of the market, particularly the market of people coming from China. That market grew by 25% over the year to September last year. Speaking of tourists, there are some rather high-profile visitors coming to your city later this year. For a few days in the middle of November, the city of Brisbane will be the focus of the world when the leaders of the G20 come to town. Now, I'm not sure you fully might appreciate yet just what you're in for here, but on the weekend of 15-16 November, you can expect the biggest gathering of global leaders ever assembled in Australia to be in your city. Australia can host this meeting with a strong reputation for economic performance. You might not know this from reading much of the domestic discussion, but most, if not all, of the G20 membership look at our relative growth, financial stability, banking soundness, public finances with a good deal of admiration. That has given Australia, at the margin, just a little bit of additional credibility in putting forward our agenda for the G20. What is that agenda? Well, that's what I want to talk about for a few minutes. In essence, the Australian agenda for G20 is growth. It's trying to focus on improving global growth, with a particular focus on enabling investment, including but not only infrastructure investment, and enacting structural reforms which will raise the potential growth performance of the economies of the G20. And the economies of the G20, by the way, are 85% of the world's GDP. At their meeting in Sydney in February, a very successful meeting, the G20 ministers, finance ministers and central bank governors agreed to come to future meetings, and particularly the summit in November here in Brisbane, with proposed policies that would have the effect of lifting the level of our collective GDP in the G20 by about 2% by the end of 5 years. Now, let me talk a little bit about what that means and why it's significant. So the idea is that the level of the real GDP of the G20 group collectively is 2% bigger, or maybe even just a little over 2%, by the end of 5 years. You could achieve that by lifting the annual rate of growth by 0.4% per year for 5 years, or more likely, because reforms take a bit of time to have effect, bigger increases in growth but a little bit later in the period. It doesn't mean growth is 2% higher every year for something like the G20 GDP that grows at 3 or 4% a year. To add 2% every year to that would be an extraordinarily large effect, and no one believes that's feasible. But 2% cumulative effect by the end of 5 years is a big deal. Just in case you think that's not such a big deal, let's contemplate the magnitudes. If we were to achieve that 2% aspiration, that would mean something of the order of $2 trillion of additional output in the global economy. Something like 15 million extra jobs around the G20 and hundreds of billions of dollars of additional revenue from taxes for governments. So we're talking serious money here. Let me be clear also about what this does not mean. This goal is not to be achieved by clever programs of cheap money devised by central banks, nor is it to be achieved by fiscal adventurism on the part of governments. In fact, one of the things we're trying to do is to shift the conversation away from the so-called growth versus austerity discussion that's characterized much of our global debate in recent years. I think that's ultimately a rather sterile discussion. Nobody's ever really achieved sustained growth by austerity, but equally the approach of simply ignoring the gaping hole in the public finances of some countries, not this one, but some others that are in the G20, I mean, that just doesn't have credibility anymore. So we need a refocused conversation around things that spur growth potential, and which would mean, by the way, among other things, that the accommodative policies that central banks presently have in place would get more traction. But these things, the things that spur growth potential, are demanding for governments. There's something of a tendency for governments, when asked to outline their growth plans for an exercise like this, to list the things that they already want to do for political purposes, and then to claim that that will help growth. Now, some of those things may well help growth. But in fact, many of the things that are needed to spur growth seem not to make it onto such lists quite often. I'm talking about things that boost competition in markets, that genuinely free up international trade, that reform the financing and the governance of infrastructure projects and reform the pricing of use of infrastructure, that put retirement incomes onto sustainable footings, that realign incentives, that allow exchange rates to be more market determined, that encourage labour mobility and participation, that strengthen human capital, that minimise tax distortions and so on. Many of these things often don't make it onto the to-do lists in quite the way that perhaps they should. So, for the G20, and I'm not aiming this comment particularly at Australia at all, it's for the G20 as a group, there's some hard thinking to do between now and November. Time will tell whether the countries of the G20 are up to that. But if not now, when? These issues are very real ones for Australia, for we face considerable challenges too. And in saying that, I'm not really referring here to the current discussion we're having about the so-called handover from mining to non-mining, as difficult a challenge as that is. By now, the proverbial pet shop galahs are all talking about this. Where will the growth come from as the mining investment boom subsides? My guess is actually that plenty of people who never thought mining would add to growth in the first place are now fretting about what will happen when we don't have it as a source of growth. Well, I've talked a lot about this question in other speeches, so I don't want to go into that again today. Let me make just a couple of very high-level comments about this matter. The first is, if we manage to absorb the upward phase of the biggest terms of trade boom in more than 100 years without overheating the economy, and if we manage to also avoid a slump in the downward phase, that would be a major achievement, not something we've managed before, actually, in previous episodes. Well, I think by and large we have managed the first part, reasonably well. Whether we will manage the second part remains to be seen. There are some promising early signs, in my view, that things may turn out not too badly here. But early signs are just that, they're early. It's way too soon to count any chickens about this at all. And let's also be clear that the capacity of policy to fine-tune this outcome is very limited. But more importantly for today's discussion, moving on from the current conjunctural issues, even if we do manage to get through this episode as successfully as we might dare hope, major long-run challenges will remain before us. And so I want to highlight a couple of these now. The first of them is fiscal sustainability. And the debate about fiscal policy, in my opinion, has been overly focused on budget outcomes in particular years. Are we in surplus this year or not? But the real issues are not so much that. The real issues are medium-term ones. And put very simply, there are things that we want to do, good things that we want to do as a society, things that we voted for, that are not fully funded by the taxes we'll be paying over the medium term. And that's starting to become clear, actually, as we move closer to the May budget. Here I would refer you, if you haven't read it, to the very important speech given last evening by my colleague, the Secretary of the Treasury, Martin Parkinson, that set out a number of these issues with great clarity. Now, our situation is hardly dire at all by the standards of other countries. But neither are the issues trivial. And as a country, we need to have a conversation about these matters. The second issue, and it's related actually, is demographics. More people will be moving into retirement and fewer people entering the workforce as we go forward from here. Now, our regular discussion about how the labour market doesn't pay much attention to this, it's understandable that with very public announcements of job shedding, albeit a number of those job losses are some years into the future yet, people become worried about jobs and they ask, where will the future jobs come from? So there are two things to say here. The first is that jobs will come from areas that we can't see yet and haven't contemplated. Let me give you an example. In the middle of 1991, at the low point of the last serious recession that we had, people were extraordinarily pessimistic about the future of jobs. The rate of unemployment was in double digits. There'd been a lot of job shedding in the economy, and people were very pessimistic, and I remember this very well. Today, 20 years later, there are almost 4 million more jobs in the economy now than there were then. The rate of unemployment, even though it's gone up a little bit in the last year, is just over half what it was back then. It's worth noting, by the way, that none of those additional net gains in employment came in manufacturing. This is not to denigrate manufacturing, which remains an important employer, and I believe will continue to do so. But the manufacturing sector shed 100,000 jobs over the period from the middle of 1991 to now. The point is that other sectors increased their employment. Mining employment tripled, and that alone offset numerically the decline in manufacturing. And that's before we get to talk about construction, healthcare, a number of other service sectors and so on. And as of today, even with we've had a soft labour market for the past year, even with that, there are more jobs in the economy today than ever before. The second thing to say is that cyclical things aside, the more likely problem in the medium term won't be one of not enough jobs, but not enough workers. At present, the number of new entrants to the labour force each year after finishing education exceeds the number retiring. 10 years from now, it's quite possible that those two numbers will be about the same. That's quite a big change. The question won't be where will the jobs come from, but where will the workers come from? Now, it's true that the workforce can grow with migration, and it will. migration is a major source of growth in population in Australia. But we need to remember that migrants also retire. And so the characteristics of the migrant inflow matter when judging what the net effect on labour availability would be. So the point is that demographic trends point in the direction, and we've known this for a long time now, they point in the direction of a smaller proportion of the population working and a larger proportion needing support in their later years, even as other demands on public finances for the provision of social goods is going up. That looks like a pretty uncomfortable combination, actually. How do we reconcile that? Well, the answer, and I think the only answer, is growth, particularly productivity growth. Now, to some extent, hopefully, we can lessen some of these demographic difficulties and some of the fiscal difficulties through higher labour participation rates for longer. You know, we're going to be working later into our lives than were our parents. But most of all, we need higher productivity of those working. That means making the system as flexible as possible and as encouraging as possible to innovation. That's why, folks, the G20 agenda about growth is pertinent for Australia. I dare say it is also pertinent for the United States. Neither the US nor Australia are really just talking idly in some intellectual way about other countries lifting their growth performance. We're asking, how do we lift our own growth performance in the future? Now, comparing Australia and the US, there's one interesting thing to say which is good for Australia, and that is the US, in most respects, is the productivity leader. The levels of productivity in the US typically are higher than elsewhere. So for us, there's an opportunity to catch up. Now, there may be various reasons why the US does so well in productivity, some of which we can't emulate. But it's hard to believe that there wouldn't be some gains, and possibly substantial ones, from a process of catching up a bit more to where the US is. The US itself, of course, is different. If you're the leader, there's no catch-up for you. And it's harder to push the productivity frontier out. When you think about this, actually, observers of the US have differing views about America's prospects to improve its productivity growth in the future. Some are pessimistic, some are optimistic. My own feeling, for what that's worth, is that the United States remains an immensely innovative society, and I think that's grounds for cautious optimism. So in the end, increasing the potential growth of the G20 countries and our own economy is a challenge of the first order. The 2% goal is subject to uncertainty. It wasn't just plucked out of the air. It was based on research, but all that sort of research is inherently difficult to do, dependent on a range of assumptions, and so on. But hopefully, that goal will force us all in the G20 to confront the right set of questions. Now, before I finish, it's probably appropriate, given that the financial system inquiry is underway, to make a few remarks about the role of finance in supporting growth. The Reserve Bank has made a thumper of a submission, 250 pages, to the inquiry, and if you're having trouble sleeping, it's at www.rba.gov.au. It points out there's a few essential things that we want the financial system to do, and I think it's important that these key things for finance to do are kept in our mind over the period that we debate this this very important set of issues. What do we want finance to do? It's not that complicated, actually. We want it to provide a way of exchanging value, that is, payments, services. We want it, secondly, to transfer resources, real resources, or financial resources, between the people who save, who consume less than their income, to the people who invest. That is, we want the financial system broadly defined to do intermediation, and we'd like it also to watch how the people who borrow the money use it, because we'd like to get it back again with interest over time. So intermediation and credit monitoring, that's a key function. Thirdly, we want the financial system to transfer, to price, and to manage risk. This is an area that in some ways went a bit wrong, one would have to say, during the crisis. And then fourthly, importantly, the financial system provides liquidity to the community, the service of making our assets more liquid, more able to be turned into cash if needed than would otherwise be the case. Over the period since just before the Industrial Revolution, really, the provision of this kind of service to the community by finance, there's no question that that accelerated growth. There's no question that it facilitated the Industrial Revolution, and that pushed up growth in living standards and has continued to do so over the past 200 years at a pace not seen before in history. So finance is important. And recent history has continued to be one of innovation and growth. The development of new products, efficiencies in process, the use of information technology in ways that couldn't have been conceived of even just one generation ago, all these things have held promise, and they still do. Unfortunately, and this is stating the obvious, the problems that developed in the international financial system, due mainly to serious shortcomings in key markets and institutions in some of the world's most important countries, have meant that finance has globally been too often growth reducing rather than growth enhancing in the past 5 years. The world learned, or be more accurate to say we relearned, the lesson that finance actually has its own cycle. It's a cycle of risk seeking and then risk aversion, of leverage and deleveraging, a cycle of confidence and then sometimes overconfidence followed by fear or even panic. So the financial system is capable of enhancing growth. It's capable of helping the economy, of helping it to absorb shocks. It's also capable of being a source of shocks itself. That's something that we've relearned. So given that, it's not surprising that internationally, the focus since 2008 has been one of repair, of rethinking and of regulatory reform, and in all frankness, increased regulation. That remains a big part of the G20 agenda, by the way, and there are some very important milestones that we hope the G20 will pass or reach by November. In this country, our crisis experience was much less wrenching than in so many of those other countries. Our supervisory framework stood up to the test well. Our key institutions proved to be robust. And generally they had, for the most part, the odd exception, not perfect, but for the most part, our main institutions have been run prudently and carefully, and that's to their credit, and that stood them in good stead through the crisis. Nonetheless, there are lessons for us to learn and adjustments to make, both for supervisors and for financial institutions. And it's very much in our interests to absorb those lessons and to make the sensible changes, including the ones that come as part of better international standards. The inquiry then offers the opportunity to distill those lessons and to contemplate the future. A financial sector that reliably and efficiently and safely services the community's needs. That is, a financial sector that's the handmaid of industry is a boon to growth and prosperity, and it can play an important role in achieving the growth that we want to see. Thank you very much.
Over this way, good sir. Come over here to the cheap seats with me. Actually, that's got a nice ring to it, doesn't it, sir? You know? Just saying, Sir Glenn Stevens. I mean, Governor's nice, but Sir would be better.
That's not a choice I expect I'll have to make.
Just saying, I'm personally going for Dame asks a lot of questions that are annoying, which you're about to find out. So, I notice we have the glasses overturned, not half full, not nothing. So, okay, just writing the balance before we start. Look, there's been a lot of discussion at the moment, as you're well aware, about reinventing the GST wheel as a way of, I suppose, stemming the revenue losses to states and territories that's come about from this online revolution we're in. Given the Reserve Bank has the responsibility for overseeing the payment system, can we talk a little bit about the threats that you see to our regulated payment system when you can buy and pay over the internet for services that produce no revenue and pay no tax in Australia, including GST, and don't use the Australian payment and clearing system?
Well, I don't want to get into tax matters. That's a set of issues that's, as you know, under careful consideration in the places where they know about tax, and that's outside my field. On the payments system, actually, when you make payments online, offshore, there is still an Australian payment system link there, because ultimately the money's coming out of a bank account and your bank is processing that, the credit card companies are processing it, and so on. So our responsibility is safety, reliability, efficiency, competitiveness of the payment system. I think from that perspective, what we're seeing is increasing prospect of competition for the established players in that space. Now, we need to be sure that that the competition doesn't undermine standards of security and safety, but provided we can maintain that, actually, some competition in the payment space is probably, from a consumer point of view, to be welcomed, per se. That doesn't take away from the difficulties of you know, the GST not applying on certain imported things and so on. But as I say, that's properly considered, I think, in Canberra. Not in Martin Place.
Do you think, though, that we're far away from that concept of having an essentially cashless society? And, you know, will the price of that convenience be too high in terms of what you're talking about, in terms of control and privacy?
It's an interesting question, whether we're moving to a cashless society. People have talked about that for a very long time. And unquestionably, the electronic methods of payment are growing in their penetration of the system and their convenience. It remains the case, though, thus far, and this may surprise you, that the demand for the folding stuff, which of course is our product...
Do you have any you wanted to give me at all today? I was just curious.
I don't get free samples, so I can't.
And the one perk I thought I'd get today is
Dash. I sit there and sign them all day. But
it's a very nice signature. If I could forge it, I would.
But the demand for notes rises about 5 or 6% a year, very consistently. It still is growing at about that pace, so there's $60 billion of that out there circulating around. And so far, we don't see a major impact on that demand from electronic payments. It's likely eventually, I guess, that we will, but so far, cash seems to be still a pretty useful payment device for many purposes.
King, as they say in the classics. Well, let's go global. You did whet our appetite with a lot of G20 talk, and, you know, we're a big fish in the G20 sea this year. So the RBA, though, represents Australia on the Financial Stability Board, and we've seen some stability returning to Northern America and parts of Europe. But Russia, to use an oldie but a goodie from Paul Keating, they seem a tad recalcitrant. What's the Reserve Bank thoughts on the havoc that the situation with Russia and the Ukraine is causing, and what effect might that have on Europe and Australia?
The The principal effects, I suspect, still will lie in the geopolitical military space, about which I'm not competent to offer an opinion. I think economically, so far, there hasn't been huge disruption globally in financial markets, would be my assessment. The Ukrainian financial system and the Russian have both come under some pressure, but that hasn't really spread too far beyond those borders. And so I think at this point, I don't see a material threat crystallising financially or economically from that source. I think the issues are more political and strategic.
You did mention in your speech too the position on unemployment, and it is an increasingly hot topic. I mean, 500 jobs lost here just yesterday in Brisbane when the BP oil refinery closed. It seems that we're in line for a relatively, by Australian standards at least, high unemployment rate over the next few years. Is that inevitable, or do you think these demographic...
Well, look, I don't think these things are inevitable, and actually the unemployment rate we have right now of about 6%, and we think it probably will go up a little bit further yet. That's certainly higher than we want to see. But over the long run of history, actually, that's not a high number. I mean, a seriously high unemployment rate in the past has been 10 or 11%, as I was quoting in the talk. So it's important, I think, to keep some perspective there and to remember that, yes, the economy is adjusting, some jobs are being shed, and that's no doubt unquestionably difficult for those communities. I fully agree with that. But jobs can grow elsewhere, and if we have overall macroeconomic stability, which is what we're trying to deliver, and a sensible range of policies in other fields and for the business community and the labour market and so on, you can grow jobs. We have done in the past and we will again.
More PR people and economists would be a good start, I would think.
I'm not sure whether more economists would be universally welcome.
Well, we PR people are very popular. Look, a lot of tough federal budget talk going on, and you did mention that briefly with Treasury Secretary Martin Parkinson quoted as saying Australia must be prepared for a recession in the next decade. I mean, your thoughts on the R word?
Well, the history is recessions come because economies have cycles. We've built this little, it's a slight fairy tale that we haven't had one for 23 years. I myself think we've had a couple of episodes of slowdown that, but for the accident of the quarterly national accounts, might have been labelled recessions, but they were small ones. And the point here is, market economies have recessions. A recession's a period where activity goes down briefly, usually for 6 months to a year, and then you grow again. No one can promise that there won't be recessions in the future. There will be. I could virtually promise you, I think, that someday out there, there'll be one. I can't tell you when or why, but if you look at the history of any market economy, they happen. So the notion that you will always avoid them, I think, is setting yourself up for disappointment. The trick is to be in such a situation that when the downturn comes, they're small and brief. And so the downturn we had at the end of 2008, the one we had in the end of 2000, early 2001, in some metrics you might call those recessions, but very shallow ones, brief ones, and quite quickly we were back to growth. And hence today our economy is 13%. I think it is larger than in 2008, whereas the British economy is still smaller than it was then. So it wasn't just the depth of the downturn, it's how slow the recovery is that also matters. So I think recessions are a feature of market economies. They happen. They will in the future, as they have in the past. But good policy should be able to have us in a position where they're not really deep ones and debilitating ones, they're brief ones. And if we could achieve that, that would be no small achievement.
You also, well, earlier I was talking to a few people, and there are indeed a lot of cranky bankers out there. I don't know if you noticed, but they're cranky. They're cranky about, you know, the new capital regulations under Basel III, and they're saying they're too restrictive. And in terms of Australia, we already have incredibly strong bank regulations via the good RBA and APRA. So in your view, do you think we're paying the price for other nations for their lack of self-control earlier?
No, I don't think so. I think those countries have been paying a very high price for the various things that went wrong, and there'd be discussion over the question of the, you know, whether the bankers and other participants were more at fault, whether the regulators had failures, and I don't want to get into that. But financial crises are extremely costly. You know, you're talking about tens of percentage points of GDP cost to the community and lost income and budget support and so on. That is a massive amount. The likely cost of slightly higher capital and an additional margin for safety for banks like ours is minuscule in comparison to the thing that you're trying to avoid. So I think what APRA's doing is they're implementing the international standards. And it's true that they're implementing some of them a bit quicker than some of the others are, but that's basically because the others can't implement them at the same speed. They're not starting from the same strong position. We are starting from a strong position, and it's, I think, an advantage to our system to be able to say, look, we're there quickly. And I don't think it's all that hard to get to where they need to be honest with you. So we support the implementation of Basel. There are certainly things that have come forth in the international regulatory agenda that we have, you know, to some extent, argued against from our own position. But by and large, a country of our size, you can't realistically say, well, I'm not going to do this and just go my own way. That's not feasible.
The rising level of concern that you've indicated a couple of times now in other speeches, and again to some degree today, about house prices, is that really just a market catch-up after some years of stagnation, do you think? Or should banks and government be concerned when interest rates, as they, you know, are setting sometime in the future, are likely to see a lot of defaults because they had that low interest credit?
Well, I think the key thing here is there are two things there. There's house prices per se, and our message is that people should remember prices can fall as well as rise. They don't just rise, they fall sometimes, and they have in this city and in Sydney a couple of times in the past decade. There's been a period where prices went down, so it's not a sure bet. That's the first thing. And the second thing is that credit quality in the future, when one day interest rates are higher than the low levels we have today, that's really about the quality of lending decisions that banks make. And our message to them, there's not much evidence at this point that lending standards have deteriorated materially, but our message, and I know that APRA is giving this message very clearly to the banks, is don't lower the standards.
Things like 30-year fixed mortgage terms are available in the States, but not in Australia.
Well, they are, but that term part of our yield curve is not sufficiently developed to really allow the financial institutions to price a loan to you for that long. You can't get out that far. The fact is most people still take floating rates here anyway, but we don't have a mature 30-year part of the yield curve sufficiently to allow the lenders to raise money and do all the appropriate hedging and so on they need to do to offer that product.
You mentioned before how tough it is for regulators and governments to look past and have that grand plan, that grand vision, be bold about what we need for the future. Do you have hope that we're going to get to that point any time in the next decade or so?
That's a pretty big question, but I think from the little narrow world of the Reserve Bank, we've got a clear policy framework that I think has worked very well for 20 years, and it's strongly supported in the financial community and in the political community, so that's good. Some of the challenges that we have around ageing, fiscal and so on, these are things that require, I think, a lot of discussion in the community at large, and they have to go beyond just occasional sound bites. There's got to be serious discussion. That's a difficult task.
And sometimes unpopular.
And that is the job of the political leadership, and I think they're acutely conscious of that. So we can only, I think, give them our encouragement and goodwill to do that.